We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
Higher Side Chatters, please, while you're listening to the intro you've heard plenty of times before, open up another browser, go to podcastawards.com. THC is honored to have been nominated. We're in the general category, and you can vote once a day until the 15th. If you're hearing this after the 15th, well, I'll just go fuck myself.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
People, tonight we find ourselves on the eve of the national election, a mile marker on the highway of absurdity and smoke and mirror theatrics where Americans enjoy the false sense of empowerment and the almighty lever pull. Well, I'm Greg Carlwood, and I don't really give a shit about the national election, you know? I've got other concerns. Do we really live in a world of random successes and unpredictable tragedies, or are there unseen writers and directors of reality plotting out events to such a detailed degree of precision that it boggles the fucking mind? Do Hollywood pop stars rise and fall by the quality of their talents or because they did their time in the satanic sex parties in the Illuminati? Do raving lunatics fire on crowds, assassinate inspirational leaders, and suicide bomb buildings all seemingly at random? Or are they unwilling actors corralled at the scene, finger on the trigger, waiting for their brain to scream action from the dark recesses of their subconscious? Well, today's guest has spent a large chunk of his life exploring the depths of what he calls this high weirdness for decades, writing articles in nearly every underground magazine, counterculture publication, and conspiracy website imaginable, a self-described crackpot historian and author of several books, most notably his work on Charles Manson and the connection to the deeper conspiracy. He's a gonzo journalist, the conspiracy community, and I've become a huge fan as of late. Adam Gorightly, say hello to the people.
Hello, people.
Hey, thanks for being here. Yeah, you have written on a ton of alternative topics, UFOs, black magic, the Montauk Project, the list goes on, and I definitely appreciate your less than serious style of writing. Let's start with one of my favorite articles that you've written, which is an interpretation of Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, because I grew up as a Kubrick fan, but when that one came out, I didn't get it, but now it makes a little more sense, but you basically assess that Eyes Wide Shut is an exposure to the goings-on of the Illuminati and Project Monarch. But for those who don't know, what is Project Monarch?
Well, assuming your audience knows what MKUltra is, which was that government-sponsored program back in the days, went on in the during the Cold War, where the CIA was using all kinds of methods to control minds, using drugs and electrotherapy and on different things, you know, techniques that were imported from the Nazis, you know, the whole
right.
Project Paperclip thing, became MKUltra, and a spinoff of that, allegedly, is Monarch Mind Control Programming. I first became exposed to a lot of this stuff through a book came out in the late 70s by Walter Boert, entitled Operation Mind Control. Are you familiar with that title?
Yeah, I've heard the title. I've never read the book, but I've heard the title and I've heard it talked about a lot. But I guess Monarch is like a sexual twist on MK Ultra.
Well, when he published that book in the late 70s, it came out, kind of caused a stir. He wasn't talking about Monarch at that point, mm-hmm. but then all of a sudden, all the copies vanished. Somebody bought them up. It was probably a government job. Didn't want some of this information released. Boert, then in the late 90s, came out with his second edition of this Operation Mind Control. And that's where I first read about a lot of the Monarch revelations. And one of the, he just used people's initials as his sources, but one of his sources, who he called O, later turned out to be Kathy O'Brien, if you're familiar with that name. And she's one of the first people that came out talking about Monarch, as far as I could tell. There's also somebody named Bryce Taylor that is a pseudonym. And so this Monarch, you know, according to the witnesses, the victims, was a spinoff of MK Ultra and used different types of programming and such as Wizard of Oz imagery and these type of things to create their basically alters in their victims, different personalities that they could use to be assassins and drug couriers and different things. Mm-hmm. And so I got interested in this. This was the late 90s, and it seemed like this, that's when they first started talking about it. And all of a sudden you heard of, suddenly people came out and were talking that they'd been Monarch victims. And if you look, if you continue to follow the trend, it's just exponentially grew since that time. Much like when people started first being regressed for
UFO abductions.
Yeah, UFO abductions. That seemed also to take off during a certain period in the late 70s to mid 80s. And something similar now is this super soldier stories you're hearing about. I just a few years ago, there was a guy named Aaron McCollum who came out talking about this, and all of a sudden, you have all kinds of super soldiers popping up. So anyway, I delved into all this, a lot of this Monarch program and how Monarch works. They would allegedly take children at the time of birth and initiate them into this Monarch programs, and the parents were all involved in this. And it, the name, you know, the it's alleged that the Illuminati are behind all of this, that super secret organization that's right in our face, I guess, with all the imagery we see nowadays. And so it was this huge intergenerational program that who knows goes how far back, and that's kind of the Monarch programming. They use these different subliminal images and messages and like movies to program this process, and they'll use these things in the Monarch programming. And supposedly, from what I've read in these books, the Wizard of Oz is used a lot in this programming. So with that background in mind, when I saw Eyes Wide Shut, I started seeing all kinds of imageries and hints and winks to you know, the Wizard of Oz within the film. I thought, is this some type of programming tool? You know, are they using Eyes Wide Shut? Was what's his name, Stanley Kubrick, using this sort of as a revelation of the method? I'm sure you've mm-hmm. heard that term,
right?
And so just going through the film, I can take you through a few scenes if you'd like, so
yeah,
I can point out some of the Wizard of Oz imagery. The first thing that you see in the movie, there's this lavish party that's hosted by some bigwig named Ziegler, and he's actually played by Sidney Paul Pollock in the film, who was a director. He directed, I believe, Kramer versus Kramer and different movies. And mm-hmm. so we see at this party Tom Cruise character there, and he's Dr. Bill. Refer to him as Dr. Bill is at this party, and he finds himself seduced by two beautiful models, as they call them. Remind me to talk about models in a minute, because the term models is kind of a code word. And so they're kind of leading him into an apparent menage a trois. And when Dr. Bill asks them where they're taking him, and they, as they lead him away by his arm in arm, they tell him where the rainbow ends. And I thought, that's interesting. So that appeared to be an allusion to Monarch programming. Later on, after that scene, there's also an interesting scene in there where beautiful young lady who's nude in the guy who's hosting the party, Ziegler, in his bathroom. She's ODing. Mm-hmm. And so Dr. Bill comes and he's able to revive her. So just keep in mind that, drug addiction is another common modus operandi in the control of these monarch sex slaves. So the women at these parties, it's kind of inferred that they're these type of programmed sex slaves. And so, with this whole monarch programming, it's interesting that just going back, it allegedly deals with programming boys and girls and their roles, and by using sexual molestation and other trauma such as satanic ritual abuse as part of the programming. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes the family members are used in this this process. So moving on, we see the next allusion to the Wizard of Oz when Dr. Bill, he's going to some party, so he goes to rent a cloak and mask from a place, a costume store called Rainbow Costumes, which happens to be located above another shop called Under the Rainbow. Not sure what to make of all this, but it seems keeps popping up. Now, at this costume shop, he's dealing with an owner there, and the owner catches his underage daughter half-nude with two apparent drag queens and becomes visibly upset. Then in a later scene, the shop owner does an about-face, and he ends up pimping out his daughter to these same drag queens, and he tries to interest Tom Cruise character, Dr. Bill, in her as well. So there's this transformation we see there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the monarch programmers or the people who've been programmed will talk about transformation as being in a trance. That was the name of Kathy O'Brien's book, Transformation in America. So in the film, there's this transformation of father to pimp and daughter to prostitute. And this is part of that monarch symbolism, which is one of transformation of the caterpillar into butterfly. And it's kind of a mocking irony, because a butterfly is seen as this creature of transformational beauty. Mm-hmm. So to me, that appears to be part of the deception of this programming to delude its victims into believing they've been transformed into something magical and full of one. Follow the yellow brick road, which, this twilight language that a lot of researchers who've looked into this talk about, like Michael Anthony Hoffman and James Shelby Downard, this twilight language embedded as a form of mocking wordplay, used in a symbolic and subliminal fashion. Mm-hmm. At first, now going back to the model, they call these women's models in this movie. Going back to Walter Bowert in his book, Operation Mind Control, he referred to another book, which is very rare and it still might be difficult to find, called The Control of Candy Jones by a guy named Donald Bain. You familiar with that book at all?
That I'm not familiar with, no.
She was supposedly the first quote-unquote presidential model, as they called them, part of the MK Ultra program. Candy Jones was married to a guy named Long John Nibble. And for those of you who are into this type of podcasting and radio going back way before Art Bell, before Billy Goodman, going way back, there was a guy in the 50s, 60s named Long John Nibble. And he had an all-night show in New York over a big radio station. I think it was WNBC, and it broadcast across the country. And he was into interviewing UFO saucer people and just interesting guests. Long John Nibble, you can, if you do some searching, you can find some of his old broadcasts here and there. I got a collection of them. But anyway, he married a lady named Candy Jones, who had been a model and a dancer and this and that, and she helped him with his radio program. And she also had split personalities she seemed to go into, you know, much like Sybil from the movie. So Long John Nibble didn't know quite what was going on to her, so he took her to a psychotherapist or a hypnotist, and they put her under regression, and under that it was revealed that she was a victim of an MK Ultra program, and she was one of the first presidential models who was used as a drug mule, not a drug mule, that's some of the other Monarch people, but as a courier, message courier for intelligence agencies, and also as a sex toy of the rich and famous politicians and whatnot. And that's what how the Monarch slaves were used nowadays in the books of what's her name, Kathy O'Brien, the others, that such people as Ronald Reagan and Bob Hope and even the Clintons on and on are all using these Monarch-controlled sex slaves. So that's where the term presidential model comes in. They say some suggest that Marilyn Monroe was one of those presidential models.
Yeah, that's actually another really weird angle to the mind-controlled sex slave, is that they sometimes are turned into Hollywood stars and music stars, and that seems like, doesn't that seem a little risky? Isn't that an unnecessary risk when you can just, you know, kill them and go get another kid? Seems kind of weird.
Yeah, it would seem so, but who knows? And I don't know what to make of a lot of this stuff, really. Some, like I was correspondent and friends with Jim Keith, who wrote a lot of great conspiratorial books and died under mysterious circumstances a decade ago or so. But he brought up, and this is pretty evident to a lot of people, that yes, indeed, there has been MK Ultra and these shenanigans that have gone on are still probably going on. But to cover the tracks of the perpetrators, you always have these red herrings, this stuff thrown into the mix to just confuse the matter all the more, and to murky the water so everybody will think that it's all a bunch of nonsense to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so there's all this misinformation out there, you know, or seeming disinformation.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the biggest challenge, is you've got, first, you got the disinformation, then you've got the people who just want attention. It really makes it tough to cut through and find something legitimate.
Yeah. And even in my own life, I think I've been messed with and tampered with. And I don't want to sound like I'm foaming at the mouth or anything. But,
oh, yeah, but you've written about that a little bit. Let's talk about that. I mean, you've written a lot of pieces and a lot of subjects, been involved in the conspiracy community for a while. And it's always odd to me that some people seem to die under mysterious circumstances, while some people are, you know, allowed to just go on for years and years.
Yeah.
But what have you experienced in that kind of realm of being messed with?
Well, first of all, in my own mind, to make myself feel better about doing this and not go paranoid, and there were times when I started going down that path, I try to keep a perspective and sense of humor, and even delude myself to thinking that those out there that are doing bad deeds or monitoring us. They find my work amusing, so they let me carry on. When I was really got into heavily researching all the mind control stuff when I was writing the Manson book on Manson, The Shadow Over Santa Susanna, Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos, and I started that project. Originally, I was just looking. There was all these rumors of mind control around the Manson family, so that's kind of how I started that project and it evolved into the book. But during that period, there was some, I remember some odd things happening. One, this happened like on at least four occasions, twice when I was at home and twice in a Mexican restaurant. When I was at home, I was sitting in the same spot, and at the Mexican restaurant, I was interestingly sitting at the same table. And I felt my body temperature go up and my head felt like it was about ready to explode. I was just, my body temperature went up. Who knows? My wife was looking at me, looked all weird. Wow, he turned red. What the hell's going on? I don't know. You know, you start kind of freaking out. Then after a couple minutes, it would subside and go away. And that happened on a few occasions. And I, you know, in my paranoid conspiratorial part of my mind, thinking somebody beaming some microwave weapon on me. Of course, that's how a lot of the mind control, you know, people say they're being mind controlled now. They're using this type of electronic harassment. So that was kind of a weird thing. I could have ate something maybe that caused that, or but I've never had that happen before or since. It was interesting. I was sitting the same place on, you know, these different occasions, like somebody could have beamed something through a window. You hear the stuff. Who knows? I don't know.
It's totally possible. I mean, when researchers come down with cancer, you know, it could be years of manipulation from behind the scenes.
Yeah, and so that happened. That was probably in the late 90s when we talk about people mysteriously dying. I was, I wrote a book about Kerry Thornley, and I was in contact with a guy named Ron Bonds who ran Illuminet Press. Are you familiar with them from back in the day?
Illuminet Press? No, I'm not.
That was the going, that was the conspiracy publisher. He's a good guy out of Atlanta, Georgia, that area. Published all of Jim Keith's books.
Okay.
And Jim Keith was good friends with Ron Bonds. In fact, at the time of his death, he and Ron Bonds were working real closely, and they were going to publish Kerry Thornley's JFK assassination book. They had published, and I don't know how familiar you are with Kerry Thornley, they had published Kerry Thornley's other books as well, The Idol Warriors and Zenarchy. So those were all, we've got the key three players with Illuminet Press, and they all died within about a year of each other in the late 90s under odd circumstances. Kerry died of a rare disease. Jim Keith was at Burning Man Festival out there in the desert, jumped off a stage and kind of broke his leg or injured his knee and went in for surgery and died under surgery when a blood clot went to his brain. Huh. And Ron Bonds, the publisher of Illuminet Press, died of food poisoning during the same period. And some people subscribe a conspiracy. It's interesting. Those three guys all died at the same time.
That is suspicious.
Yeah. And I'm doing more. I'd encourage folks, if this area of inquiry interests you, to check out my book, The Prankster and the Conspiracy. It's the story of Kerry Thornley, and that's a whole nother ball of wax there to get into. But as far as this thing of being monitored and harassed, I'm thinking of a few other things. I one incident, interesting, when I was I knew Robert Anton Wilson, and I interviewed him for my book on Kerry Thornley because they were friends at one time, and they were players back in the day in the Discordian Society movement, kind of a spoof religion. Kerry Thornley claimed that he was subject to just this type of harassment, MKUltra, mind control. And I will interviewed Robert Anton Wilson about on this around sometime in 2000. A friend came with me there, Greg Bishop, recorded the interview for me. Then he took it home. He was going to edit it, put it on cassette tape for me, you know. So period of time passed, probably a month or two. And I say, hey, Greg, when you get me that Wilson tape? He said, oh, okay, I'm working on it here. I'll get it to you shortly. Just hang on. So, okay, I'll give him some time, you know. He's a busy man. I wait, you know, next time I talk to Greg, a couple months or whatever. When are you going to get that Wilson tape to me, man? I got to get going on the book here. And he goes, well, I sent it out a couple weeks ago. I think you would have had it by now.
Oh, shit.
And I went, oh, okay. So it didn't show up, and I pretty much wrote it off. You know, okay. I had in my head a lot of the conversations and whatnot, so
right. Thought,
hey, wasn't meant to be. That's how you got to keep the perspective sometimes. 6 months later, it might have even been longer than that. It might have been a year. It was quite a while. The tape finally showed up.
Weird.
The packaging it was in had obviously been opened. So somebody intercepted it, listened to it, finally rerouted to me. They probably tried to listen to it, and the quality was real bad. I had to struggle to, I forget, I don't know what kind of recorder Greg was using, but
right. That
was one instance. But it was interesting. I talked to Wilson a few times on the phone, and it was always obvious that his line was tapped and he was being monitored, and he knew this. And I was on his email list, and he used to send out emails to a group. And you familiar with the Office of Information Awareness?
I've heard it thrown around before.
Well, it was a government agency that was started post 9/11 by DARPA. They got going on this, and it was headed up by John Poindexter, who was involved in, I forget what all, Bush and Reagan administration. He's
right.
A heavy intelligence guy. And it was basically, and if you look at the symbol for the Office of Information Awareness, the initials of that are IAO, which is like a Crowleyan, part of a Crowleyan ritual chant. Mm-hmm. A lot of people point to that. But if you look at the symbol, the logo they came up with, it's the eye of the pyramid with a kind of laser beam shooting out of it. It looks just like the cover of Robert Anton Wilson and Bob Shay's The Illuminatus trilogy. So this agency was put together for monitoring, doing domestic surveillance, another agency. There was such an outcry with the public that this agency like disappeared or reconstituted as something else. During this period where they had launched the Office of Information Awareness, and John Poindexter was the head. Robert Anton Wilson used to CC all his email messages to John Poindexter. And I got these, and I talked to him on the phone. I said, Bob, why the hell are you doing with it? And he said, I figure they're monitoring all my messages anyway.
might as well just
make it easy for them, and maybe this will eliminate a job and, you know, cut down on taxpayers paying for an extra position within this agency. So he was another fellow, and there's a few of the folks. These were all 60s kind of free thinkers, libertarian radicals, involved in the anti-war movements, the Robert Anton Wilsons, and a few other people like Luis Lacy I interviewed. And other associates of Kerry Thornley, and a lot of times talking to them, you hear the telltale click. I can, you know, I know that sound when a phone is bugged.
Nice.
And so these are instances of when I felt like I was being monitored. And a lot of this took back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when I was more heavily, maybe I, you
deeper
know,
in there.
did something that alerted the attention of whoever is watching us.
It seems almost like a movie in itself, but I mean, the thing is, the further down the rabbit hole I go, the weirder and more confusing the situation becomes. Like, it almost seems like all the dots connect, but you hear about these satanic rituals, and you think that they're just there to satisfy, at least I did, to satisfy some ridiculous ego and power issues, but the symbolism comes back in movies, even in Disney movies and in music. And do you think that it is just to satisfy their ego, or are they conjuring up some kind of dark energy? Do you believe in that at all, like the Aleister Crowley type stuff?
I don't know if I believe in anything.
That's
not
true.
Not trying to cop out, but believe.
Right.
My mind's open. I look into these things. I think one of the things that's going on that the... Like I told you before we got into this, I'm not really up on a lot of the imagery and things. I know Lady Gaga does stuff, and there's been rappers singing about the Illuminati, and I think some of them might, they know about the legends, and they're kind of inserting that stuff in there just to blow people's mind. I think there's some pranksterism
you gotta
going
consider
on
that.
There. Yeah, I really don't know. It seems it's more in your face as time progresses.
Definitely.
And maybe that's part of the whole revelation of the method, and a couple other books to recommend are Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare by Michael Anthony Hoffman. He gets into a lot of this stuff, and the works of James Shelby Downard, who I've written a book about. Downer, this revelation of method with all this subliminal imagery, that there's this processing that's going on over time that's basically leading us up to a point where we'll be totally controlled. And as time progresses, it becomes more in your face and more obvious. And maybe that's what's happening. Maybe that's why it's becoming more obvious that we're getting close to whatever this end time weirdness 2012 is. I don't know.
Right, we're getting very close to that.
We're talking about belief. I don't know. You can, like you're saying, when you start, if you start connecting things, you jump down a rabbit hole. I mean, with my Manson book, it's just crazy, all the connections and stuff I found in that. In any subject, if you look hard enough, you're going to start connecting things, just, you know, like in the Eyes Wide Shut, I started seeing all of these, this imagery and things that suggest, you know, it was connected to Monarch and this Wizard of Oz imagery. I don't know, it's much like the 23 number thing that Robert Anton Wilson and the Discordians got into. They kind of... put it out there as a meme in popular culture that there was something magical to the number 23, and people started seeing it everywhere. But I found when you start looking for things, you start seeing them. It's like this 11-11 thing going on. I had some friends that were into that. I was going, this is another deal. But now I seem to, I'm noticing it all the time, and it's something I was probably always seeing, but now I kind of key into it. I'll look at a clock, it's 11:11 or whatever.
That's part of what makes it so weird, is because you've got skeptics who will say, well, this is just part of, you know, this is a normal phenomenon for the human mind where you start connecting things and they're not necessarily related. But then if you go into, like, even all the different subcategories of conspiracy, like weather manipulation, then it becomes every single tsunami hurricane is weather manipulation. Then you look at the whole angle of the Project Monarch sex slaves becoming celebrities, and then it becomes, oh, well, it was Madonna, it was Marilyn Monroe, and it's like, it almost seems like no one can get popular unless they were part of these satanic orgies. It's just a weird... Oh, and also, you know, assassinations. You get into the Batman killing. Oh, that was mind control. Oh, the, you know, school shootings. Those were mind control. And it almost starts to seem like every event that that is odd on the radar is connected to the same thing. You know, I almost find myself being like, is this just a normal weird thing, a weird phenomenon, or is there something there? Because I'm still going to my 9-to-5 job, and it feels like none of this is really out there.
And it could be something that's in the collective, unconscious of the human race. These different memes and things that get planted there and grow. Mm-hmm. You talk about some of the stars. You didn't mention Britney Spears and Anna Nicole Smith. Mm-hmm. You know, the meltdowns they had. I remember I was just a couple years ago with Britney Spears. She'd broken up and shaved her head, and they had to haul her away to the hospital at one time, and it looked like she had shifted personalities. I remember the film of her. She was screaming, talking like, kind of whining like a little girl, and she shaved her head and was like, wow, that seems like a total
right. If they're not in their right mind, how can they reach that level of celebrity? It seems like you have to be a pretty savvy business person, pretty motivated, unless, of course, all of Hollywood is owned by, the Illuminati or controlled by the Illuminati, and they only let forth certain people. And that would also explain why everybody, a lot of people I know, seem to not be entertained by the most popular of culture or the most popular of music.
Yeah.
It almost seems like it's just presented to us as like, this is what you get. You like it or don't like it, it's going to make millions, and there you go.
Kind of like Lady Gaga, though. and all the weather stuff going on. I mean, I don't know what the hell to think. I'm not, I don't poo-poo it, but when you totally subscribe to this stuff, once again, that could... you go too far and see something in everything, but I've noticed the contrails, whatever the heck they are, become more prevalent over the years, and it seems like you see these checkerboards in the skies, these X's, like I don't know. Then everything that's going on the East Coast now with Hurricane Sandy, we've had these nature is like that, and weather patterns, every 100 years or whatever. So I don't get too excited about it all. But on the other hand, people talk about preparing for worst case scenario. I think folks should do that too. I don't think that's paranoid. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about your opinions on, like, the MK Ultra mind control assassins, because like I said, it seems like every high profile killing is a suspect of mind control victim. Are there any that stand out to you as more obvious?
Sirhan was a good case.
Mm-hmm.
That he'd basically written this diary where it looked like he went into a trance state, and they used the diary during the trial. Basically, his defense presented that he had gone into some sort of trance state, and Sirhan had no recollection of the shooting himself. All he remembered was going into the ambassador ballroom where RFK spoke before he was shot, and that he went and got some coffee, and the girl in the polka dotted dress gave him some coffee, and he couldn't remember anything like that. Like, he was given, perhaps there was a drug with the coffee, or there's some code word, like the Manchurian cabinet, how he's encouraged to play a game of solitaire, and how the Queen of Hearts or the Queen of Diamonds was basically that trigger. But if you look into the Sirhan case, there's a lot of meat there. I'm just touching on a couple of things, but some of the other ones, one of the things I first tripped over or talked about in my research and wrote about, I think I was one of the first persons, maybe the first, I'm not positive, but was the book The Catcher in the Rye, and how the, who was it, John Hinckley, who shot Reagan and Mark David Chapman also after he blew away John Lennon, both had a copy of the Catcher in the Rye in their possession, and it was like they were sitting there. I know Chapman was sitting there reading it very calmly. That's what they, you know, like he had just gone into his trance assassin mode, and once that was done, he had switched over into something else. So I conjectured back in the day, and this was in the early 90s, I wrote about it for Paranoia magazine, that it was used as a mechanism of control. And I started looking into this, and it was like, okay, I want to find out more about J.D. Salinger. And I learned that he was mixed up with the OSS back in the day, who later became the CIA, and that he was part of a group that basically interviewed and brought a lot of the German people, the Nazis, denazified them, as they called it back in the day. But really, if you read into it, were part of the Project Paperclip program. So it was pretty interesting that Salinger was involved in that. I found it funny. I think I'm the first person maybe connected those dots. I'll say I am.
I could be proved
wrong. Later in the movie, Conspiracy Theory with Mel Gibson, they brought out that angle. And jokingly, I was interviewed by this, I think they're still around, Newsflash. They were like they put out stories that would go viral. This about a decade ago, and radio stations would pick them up, and so that they did that angle that some guy interviewed me, and they did a couple things on me over the years, and so they just take out sound bites, and the interviewer said, I told him, yeah, Mel Gibson had ripped me off. He had heard this somewhere, and he said, are you going to sue Mel Gibson? I go, no. Better not do that, but I'd taken out a court settlement or something. So that's the news. So it got a little news play for a while, and I got interviewed by some radio stations. But anyway, we were talking about assassins.
Have you looked into a lot of the work I've seen from you is a little bit older, or the interviews I listened to are a little bit older, but have you really looked into the Batman killing, the most recent massacre?
A little bit, not much. It was funny. I was in Colorado. Where was I? I was in Boulder. But I was also around the Denver, Aurora area during that same period. And I think I was in Boulder that day. I was out doing some work. And I woke up and fired up the laptop to see what emails and whatnot. And I see the shooting... This Colorado shooting, go, holy crap, what's going on here? You know, I thought, oh, it's odd, I'm in Colorado, not far from when this went on. But boy, certainly had all the earmarks of, another lone nut. You know, there's a lot of people were alleging, there were the witnesses, that there was a second person involved. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people in the theater said that. And, another weird thing about it was that apparently there was an old comic book called The Dark Knight that was, you know, it was in the big line of Batman comics. But in that particular issue, a man goes into a theater and he kind of goes crazy and he shoots people. And the man who goes into the theater has orange hair. And if you look at the killer, he dyed his hair orange and everyone's like, oh, he was trying to be the Joker. Well, the Joker doesn't have orange hair. So the only, it seems like it might have came from that. In the same way you talk about The Catcher in the Rye, I could see this particular comic being used as a trigger. And, you know, they program him into thinking he's almost in that comic book or playing out that character. And another strange thing about it, and it's much creepier if you see the picture rather than hear the explanation, but during the London Olympics, they did some really weird opening and closing ceremonies. And in the closing ceremony, they had, like, some guys doing like a cheerleaders pyramid, and they were wearing suits, and they had the exact same hair. They had, you know, orange hair that was all messed up, and it looked just like him. And it seemed really odd that they would. It almost like they were parading their covert activities at the London Olympics.
Crazy, yeah. I'd heard about the comic book. You know, there's another thing you can point to, other assassins. When they did the court hearing for this guy, and he looked all out of it, you know, like he'd been drugged up. Apparently, and I forget, it was like a woman in a red dress, pink dress, something, stood up. I haven't seen the actual footage, but said something about some program that the truth needs to come out about, whatever. That's the last you heard about that, and was like, oh, what's the hell's that about? And, you know, once again, maybe was that some type of trigger to put him in an amnesia state, or was she really trying to reveal some truth about what was going on about all of this? Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, another suspicious fact is that his father was involved in, he was about to go public and exposing some evidence in the LIBOR scandal, which was a big banking scandal we heard about for like half a day.
Yeah.
A multi-billion dollar banking scandal that, you know, not a big deal. It happens all the time. Don't worry about this. Let's talk about, the football game.
Right, yeah.
It seems like that kind of thing happens when someone tries to go public. Someone in their family goes crazy or ends up dead.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
I was just going to say another, like, to get on to something that you have written about a little more, is the JFK killings. I mean, that's probably one of the highest profile suspects of a ritual killing. I know you wrote a book about the work of James Shelby Downard and the whole idea, the concept of mystical type nominee. What is that?
Oh, yeah. Mystical toponymy.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. But there seems to be a lot of evidence. Like, again, it's the dot connecting thing, you know?
Right. James Shelby Downard was the great dot connector. Kind of a gonzo conspiracy researcher, and I've written a book, James Shelby Downard's Mystical War. I first became familiar, I think, with his writings through what he's most famously known for is King Kill 33, which was co-authored by Michael Anthony Hoffman. And it was basically Downard's theories presented in this manuscript, and Hoffman helped him write it. As I looked in my research of Downard, looked at some of the original source material, he wasn't that talented of a writer. But so Hoffman, his role in that was basically to help pull his thoughts together and put it in a written format. But basically, Downard presented the theory that JFK's assassination was basically a ritual sacrifice, all part of this revelation of the method that we have been talking about, where it was used as a mass ritual to kind of process humanity and cause a trauma to the psyche, and basically, in so many words, tell the general populace that you're controlled. We took out the president when he crossed the line, and you're all expendable. That was kind of the subliminal underlying message. Downer points to a Freemasonic conspiracy behind this JFK's execution and this huge ritual that took part on the 33rd degree latitude. That's what we call about the mystical toponymy. The number 33 supposedly is the highest degree in Freemasonry. And throughout JFK's assassination, the number 3 comes up again and again. He's murdered by the triple underpass. There's three shots, allegedly, and there was the three tramps, three assassins found in Daly Plaza. Now, this 33 latitude, if you trace it across the country, which Downer does in Kingkill 33 manuscript, he traces it to such places as South Carolina, where Albert Pike founded Freemasonry, and to such sites as Alamogordo, New Mexico, where they tested the atomic bomb that was later dropped on Japan, and also the Roswell crash was on the 33rd degree, and even right. Disneyland is on that 33 degree latitude. And some people suggest that Walt was a Uncle Walt Disney was a Mason drag, and there's even a 33rd or Club 33 there. So anyway, it was Downard's contention that JFK's assassination was a Masonic ritual. That's kind of the theme or the idea behind that theory. A lot of people, for a long time, and they still do, don't believe that James Shelby Downard even actually existed. But in my mind, the research I did showed that, yeah, he was a real living and breathing human being, kind of a larger-than-life character. So that's why a lot of people think he was some type of literary creation constructed by Michael Hoffman and William Grimstead, or Adam Parfrey, who published some of his works.
It is a weird thing about the locations on the 33rd degree parallel. I mean, they also talk about that if you go into other researchers who look into the ancient pyramids of the world, they're apparently also on some type of grid, which is weird because it's supposed to be a time where, as far as we know, there was no cross-continental communication, but yet all these weird mm-hmm. structures are sort of Stonehenge also, things like that seem to be on the same planes. And it's odd because the, you know, as far as the shadow government or Illuminati or Freemasons are concerned, is there seems to be some type of knowledge of the universe that we just don't talk about. It's not taught in schools. It's sort of off the table. And to me, when you get into the satanic rituals and all that stuff, like the really dark stuff that apparently is going on top of the pyramid, it seems like there's something to this, the idea of energy, that we're just clueless about.
Yeah, these power spots, energy nodes. William Grimstead, he was into this. He was one of Downard's prodigies. And The Rebirth of Pan, that's a real rare book. But he talks about this spirit energy there that the Native Americans knew about. And there was all these mounds that were all across the country that later got plowed over or torn down. But my friend Andy Kaufman talks about some of these energy spots. People who took over the Native Americans and massacred them and whatever ended up oftentimes building military installations mm-hmm. on these same power spots. So it's like usurping that power. They know there's some type of energies a lot of times. Spiritual spots, churches, whatever, these will people, when they take over these spots, they'll put in their own power structures nowadays, whether it's some military installation or whatnot. So, yeah, that's all part of the deal. And another interesting one is Disneyland. I brought that up because another friend of mine, Walter Bosley, wrote a book called Latitude 33, where he had some weird experiences and in Disneyland, where on a carousel there, he basically said it was a type of interdimensional time travel type of teleportation device.
Weird.
And they've removed that. The carousel, I forget what the carousel is. It's no longer there, but Walter claims he met some guy from the past or future that helped well, he must have been from the past, that he was one of the architects of Disneyland originally, or involved in that, and that they knew about, you know, that's why they built Disneyland where they did, because it was one of those power spots.
Yeah, Disney's a weird thing, because everybody loves their movies. It's like every kid grows up on Disney movies, and there are a lot of researchers.
They got all that crazy Illuminati imagery in their movies as well.
Right. I mean, you can look at, now we have the technology to look at stills that you couldn't really look at back then, and you can go online and find all these weird like single cell shots where they'll say the word Illuminati or have the all-seeing eye. And one, there are a lot of researchers out there that are talking about the idea that every Disney movie involves some Disney princess, and that what that is almost teaching kids is to be materialistic and, you know, to be shallow. And to an extent, I could see that. I mean, that is definitely a theme throughout all Disney movies, to have that female role.
And maybe to be the princess in this fantasy world, you have to basically be sacrifice something in yourself, you know,
to it become a. Like, it almost seems like the Project Monarch theme.
Yeah, and so all of these, women who want to become these fantasy stars or whatever have to become part of that process, and eventually, you know, it's tragic for them, the Marilyn Monroe or. Who's Whitney Houston's of the world, they eventually pay the ultimate price.
There's also, this isn't something that I saw in the books that you provided for me to read, but you also hear the idea of the blood sacrifice, and that certain celebrities, I guess the theory is that they're involved in the Illuminati and Freemasonry, and then once they get to a certain level, they're granted an opportunity to provide a blood sacrifice to reach a level of stardom that they hadn't previously had. And you'll find that a lot of the musicians that are pretty popular have had strange deaths in their family. Kanye West is one. His mom died strangely during plastic surgery. Jay-Z was dating Aaliyah, who died in a plane crash, and he's one of the biggest moguls there is in hip-hop. And those are two examples, but there seems to be kind of a lot of them. And I guess the theory, is that you don't reach that level of stardom unless you do make some type of sacrifice.
Well, yeah, you ought to write a book. You're talking about the going down that rabbit hole and connecting those dots. Once you start looking for those things, the hits keep coming. It's like, what's his name? Dave McGowan. You familiar with his research on Laurel Canyon and the stuff he's written about that?
I've heard about Laurel Canyon, but not that name doesn't ring a bell.
The inside story of Laurel Canyon, Dave McGowan. You can find his stuff on the web. He hasn't, he decided not to write a book and get it published the traditional way, even though it's some amazing materials, and he's kind of a wry, humorous writer in his approach. But he got looking into the Laurel Canyon thing, all the rock stars that came out of Laurel Canyon in the late 60s, and all the connections they had in their families to intelligence organizations or military backgrounds. And a lot of the same themes started coming up again and again, and the mysterious deaths of all these different rock stars plugged into the community. And the history of Laurel Canyon is kind of a spooky area. So that's kind of the along the same theme of what we're talking about, you know, that went on in the late 60s. And, you know, you look at different people like Jim Morrison. His father was an admiral in the Navy, tied into intelligence and whatnot. And he actually took part in the, what they call that fabled it's basically it was a false flag operation that launched, got the Vietnam War going, and Jim Morrison's father was involved in that. If you look at these different rock stars, a lot of them had those connections in their family. Once again, talking about a bloodline or something. So, mm-hmm. you know, you ask yourself, well, why were these the people were they coming, talking, you know, they're involved in the Summer of Love and the anti-war movement and the psychedelics. And, you know, I guess McGowan doesn't come flat out and say it, but that was part of a program that was basically being instigated there as far as this mass control of society, and part of that 60s counterculture was part of this. And you know, that's what people get into when they're talking about the Beatles and their connection to Tavistock and all this, that they were basically programming the 60s generation.
Yeah, and I liked reading a lot about that stuff in your work because, you know, most of my conspiracy knowledge is pretty much post 9/11, really, because that's kind of what set mm-hmm. me off in high school. It just seemed so staged. It just did not seem like a plane would knock a building down in that fashion. I mean, but I guess that's just one of those things. You either, it just looks weird to you, or it doesn't, you know. And the people that it doesn't look weird to them, I can't really reach them. But you know, before we wrap up, I wanted to give you a minute to talk about the Manson family, because I know you've done so much research into that. And, you know, I've always only just known the cliff notes to it, you know, pretty much what you see on TV. But what are some of the misconceptions of the Manson situation and the killings there and kind of the strange connections that you've come across?
Oh, boy.
I know it's a big question, but
I've been talking about this and writing about it for so long, I've forgotten half of what I learned about it all. But misconceptions. Well, I got into it. Let's approach it this way. I got into it. There's a famous conspiracy researcher by the name of Mae Brussel. You familiar with that name?
Mae Brussel, no.
Okay, so I'm taking you back old school.
All right.
And let me preface going into Manson, you talking about 9/11. The Kennedy assassination was my 9/11. That's what got me going and questioning everything, mm-hmm. everything that came afterwards.
Right.
When I had been looking at all this stuff for so long, when 9/11 happened, it was like, oh, here we, you know, go again.
It's just review.
And so I'm kind of stuck into the old school stuff. I haven't looked in, you know, every time one of these things pops up, I go, oh, maybe it's the same script they're using. But so you're one of the new breed looking into this stuff. I'm the old school guy.
I like that.
Yeah. I should note, I was interviewed, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Visigoth and a lot of the interviews he did.
Yes, I actually listened to that one.
Yeah, he has a 9/11 page on, if you can find his website, where these subliminal images of 9/11 before 9/11 are everywhere, yeah. Which is kind of weird. But so the going back to Mae Brussel, look her up. She's really one of the people that got me into looking at conspiracy research. She was this tireless investigator. She was like a soccer mom back in the day, who came across the Kennedy assassination and got interested in it, got all 26 volumes of the Warren Commission report, started going through it, and she goes, this stinks. So she started connecting the dots, and she did a radio program, and she did this for years looking, and there's hundreds, thousands of hours of tape recordings of her getting into things, breaking them down. The last thing before she died under mysterious circumstances in the late 80s, she was looking into this military involved with Satanism and mind control, and that might have done her in. So Mabe Russell got me into conspiracy, and Mabe Russell was talking about the Manson family. And she was usually, I think sometimes she went off the deep end of the rabbit hole a little bit too deep, but she was talking about back in shortly after the Manson family murders in the early 70s that she thought it was a military mind control operation. And so that got me looking into a whole bunch of other theories that you normally people don't talk about. They're talking about them more, about the Manson family, the conspiratorial aspects, such as maybe Helter Skelter was kind of a... the Helter Skelter theory is presented by Bugliosi was a cover-up of what really went down, that... maybe there was some mind control aspects going on there. Maybe the mafia was involved. There were drug burns going on. Maybe the victims weren't as innocent as they were portrayed to be because, you know, they were involved in the drug scene. And Manson had deep connections in the rock music industry and knew people in movies. And so you got all these conspiracies going on that aren't normally talked about, and so that's what got me interested in the Manson family story. And I think that's kind of my long-winded answer to how I got involved in it. Vincent Bugliosi is interested. If you just start looking there, he was the prosecutor, the DA for this thing back in the day. Wrote the book Helter Skelter, which presented the theory that Manson was somehow influenced by... he heard the music of the Beatles, and that was one of the influences that caused them to do the mass murders there. When you look at Vincent Bugliosi, though, Mabe Russell is... she would be one of the first to point to him as being a... what did she call people like him? Investigators that get involved but will put out some of the truth but not all of the truth. And if you look later at Vincent Bugliosi, he got involved in the RFK assassination and also wrote a book about the JFK assassination, the final word that it, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin.
Yeah, kind of like almost like disinformation or just withholding.
Yeah, a disinformationalist. And so, you know, Mabe Russell pegged Vincent Bugliosi as one of those that helped cover up what was going on behind the scenes with the Manson story.
Yeah, the Manson story is just, it's really weird because, you know, the guy never killed anyone, apparently.
No.
He's in prison for life. They do. He has some strange interviews on TV, and he does not seem sane to me in the interviews that I've seen. But you know, he was deep into the music and subculture, and so you know, something had to have happened somewhere. It seems, because if he was acting the way he acts now back then, I just don't think anyone would hang around. Like, it just seems really weird.
He's crazy like a fox, I think. And that's kind of a game he plays. One time he says, he'll say some interesting things in the interviews. A lot of it's gibberish, but he'll throw out some nuggets now and then. Like after he got locked up, he asked, "Oh, I want to know who was peeing on my leash," which inferred that they had let him loose, let him out to do his thing, then they pulled him back in once he had served his purpose. After the murders, there was a guy worked for the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office, Preston Guillory. I think now he's a private eye, and he was in some of his interviews with Mabe Russell, and he said they, you know, knew Manson had this thing going on at Spahn Ranch. There had been some rape charges against him, but this was somebody who was on probation, and they knew he had weapons there, but the word Preston Guillory was it was hands off on Manson for a period of time, and he got frustrated wondering why they did that. And he believed that they were using Manson as an agent provocateur, whoever they is, you know, the alphabet soup agencies, during that whole period of COINTELPRO, where they were infiltrating the hippie movement and the Black Panthers, and so ultimately Manson was used as a pawn in a big game here, which Mae Brussels said was to undermine the whole 60s counterculture, and that after the Manson family murders, it was a long time before you saw anybody with long hair who looked like a hippie or whatever.
Right.
Portrayed positively in popular media.
Well, that becomes a question is, you know, you look at the situation, you're like, well, why would this occur? And it does seem like the 60s to me just seem like such a crazy time. And I really like what I do hear about it. But at the same time, it all comes through a filter. It's never really exactly as it was. So, but it's you ask the why, Really, the hippie movement was gaining so much steam, it seemed, and it was all about love. Love is the term they throw around more than any other. So now if you can find a guy who's looks like that and is in that movement and is murdering people or suggesting that people should be murdered, you know, you kind of throw a wrench in the whole movement, really. And I guess that seems to be part of the plan.
Yeah, and I get into it a bit, you know, the whole LSD and how that was introduced. And, you know, really, at one time, the CIA was the largest provider of acid on the planet.
Exactly. There you go. How did it get out?
And so, well, they started first using it through programs in university, and that's where the Jerry Garcia and Ken Kesey and all those people got a hold of it. But they also had safe houses set up in the Haight-Ashbury during the Summer of Love, where a notorious figure in MKUltra lore, Louis Julian West, was involved in some of these safe houses where they'd pick up some guy at a bar and dose him with LSD and take him back with a prostitute and kind of monitoring. And they're also obviously putting this stuff out into the counterculture. And that's kind of what undermines, if you looked in the early 60s with the youth movement, it was more geared toward the anti-war movement. And then in a kind of back to the land type of thing, getting off the grid. Then the drugs came into it and kind of seemed like it undermined first with the acid. And I think in some ways that generation was, some people were able to take the acid away from the spooks and kind of illuminate their minds and find some truth. But, you know, the heavier drugs came in and all this kind of really undermined and took the movement in a different direction. And maybe that was the ultimate goal, you know. And so I forget where I was going with all this. But researcher John Judge claimed that the type of acid that the Mansonoids were given was not your typical acid. It was the quote-unquote military acid. He actually had a derivative of psilocybin. I talked to John Judge and tried to find exactly where he gets some of his information sometimes. I'm not sure, but that was his contention, that they were given the military acid, and that they had a naval intelligence handler. And actually, Paul Krasner used to publish The Realist, wrote a whole story about this for Rolling Stone magazine, about the Manson family were infiltrated by this naval intelligence guy, and they actually named him Nathaniel Dyke. Rolling Stone later got sued and retracted the story. So I mean, the more you look, the deeper you look into all this stuff, it's like the less you really sure about anything.
Amen, man. And with that said, it's probably as good a place as ever to call it a day, but I had a great time talking to you. I really like your attitude, and the books you sent me were awesome. The collection of your articles in The Beast of Adam Gorelli and Happy Trails to High Weirdness were awesome reads. And you're also a musician, and this will mark the first time on THC a guest has played us out of their own interview. Is there anything coming up that we should keep an all-seeing eye on, or something you'd like to mention to the people?
I am working on a JFK assassination book, and nothing more than that. I just want to plug again to make my publisher happy. They've done a great job with Happy Trails to High Weirdness, a conspiracy theorist tour guide. So if you're going to look into one of my books, why don't you buy that one?
Yeah, and that is a good one, because as I'm getting into this stuff, I start to think, and with this show, I'm like, man, I wish I could get more connected to the community, or at least go to more conferences like the Conspiracy Con, stuff like that. And your book is really it's a narrative of those kinds of events and conferences. And yeah, it's really interesting. It's great.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course, man. And what's your website, adamgorelli.com?
Yeah, there's that, and I kind of have a goofy blog that doesn't have much to do with conspiracy, but I have, anyway, that's gorelli at wordpress.com, where I feature a devil girl of the month and a crazy bongo broad of the week, and I put a kooky Christian album cover, so that's kind of just a fun thing there. And then those who do Facebook, they can Facebook me. I'll
nice.
Take on any new friends. And so, yeah, that's kind of my presence on the web there. And yeah, thanks for playing some of my music. I'm trying to start focusing on that a bit more, too.
All right, gorelli. It's been a great chat. I hope I can have you on again to talk about some of the other subjects in your repertoire. You know, I wish you well. Stay weird, man.
Okay, thanks, Greg, and keep up the good work.
All right, man, take it easy.
Okay, later.
People, check out Adam's book and website. He's a cool guy. When this airs, the election will be over, and it won't mean shit. Hopefully you feel compelled to vote for Gary Johnson and my previous guest, Jim Gray, or more importantly, compelled to vote for the Higher Side Chats and the Podcast Awards at podcastawards.com. I really, really want to win. And if you like this show, please go and vote. I need this in my life. Later in the week, Nick Redfern will be back to talk about his new book, The World's Weirdest Places. That should be a fun conversation. So here's Adam Gorelli himself with the song The New Prophet on his album, Transmissions from a Dying Planet. That's a great name. Remember, conspiracies.net for all your conspiracy clothing needs. We will have two shirts out very soon that are new and awesome. And I'm Greg Carlwood. I think I love you. Must have known the score.
Up to us.